Hello and welcome to Season 6 of the Playground Podcast. I'm Chris Byrne, and I'm your host for this series of conversations with fascinating people from the toy industry about their works and their business. The Playground Podcast is supported by Global Toy News, The Toy Guy, and Beacon Media Group. In this episode, I talk to author and educator Rob Goldberg. He's written a fascinating and comprehensive study of the toy industry in the 1960s and 1970s, but from a unique perspective. The book is called Radical Play, and it looks at social movements of the period, war toys, race, and gender, and how those movements shape the culture and, by extension, the toy industry. Rob talks about an aspect of toy history that often gets overlooked, how toy companies themselves embraced change and responded. We spoke on February 9th, which just happened to be the 50th anniversary of the opening of Toy Fair in New York in 1974, and you'll see in a minute why that's so important. Here's our conversation. So, Rob, thank you so much for joining us today on the Playground Podcast. This is an amazing book, Radical Play. It is really an incredible social history of the 60s and 70s. And the way I looked at it is the 60s and 70s reflected in the response to toys and toy marketing. In that, one of my premises has always been that the toy industry reflects the culture, and that a lot of what you write about are people who were responding to the culture and hoping to have an impact on it. Have I missed the boat there, or is that what you're thinking?
No, I think that's precisely it. I think this book is all about how social movements and social changes of the 1960s shaped the toy industry, and how the toy industry shaped the social movements and social and cultural upheavals of the 1960s and 70s as well. I really think it went both ways.
I do too. And in the book, you talk about three major areas. You talk about gunplay and violence and war toys specifically in response to the Vietnam War, race, and how the toy aisles were integrated. And in fact, that's one of your chapters, integrating the toy aisle. And then gender, how we perceive gender. And it's so remarkable to look at this and before we even talk about the movements, looking at how the toys reflected the culture at that time. I mean, the gun toys, the dolls that were pretty much white-oriented, and then things like boys and girls. I have a copy of the very first Erector Set manual that I actually saved from a dumpster when I was getting laid off from a toy company. And it just opens up, "Hey, boys," unabashedly, "girls cannot play with this," kind of thing.
Right. I mean, the toy industry in this moment, the 1950s and early 60s in particular, I think they really were aligned with the mainstream cultural values when it came to gender, with ideas about America's role in the world. And we're catching up to the sort of the incipient civil rights struggle, right, of the 1960s and 1970s. And I think it's that mainstream representation of the world around them in the toy world, in the toy industry, in the toys they were offered at the toy stores, that made a number of different groups, people in the PACE movement, people in the civil rights struggle, people in the feminist movement, start questioning the messaging that was coming from the toy industry, and that was really coming into their homes. And it felt very personal to them. And so they began to think, okay, maybe we can target toys and the toy business in our different quests for social change. And what they discovered, often to their surprise, was that the toy makers could really help advance their visions of a more peaceful world, a more, you know, racially inclusive world, a world where women actually had a more significant role in society, which of course was the reality of American life at that time. And that the toy business, you know, didn't have to be an obstacle to them. And so many toy makers, this is a really big part of the book, really stepped forward and said, we want to tap into this because, one, we do think it's profitable. But we also want to tap into this because we actually think it's the right thing to do. You know, we're in favor of women having a more significant role in society. And yeah, we really should be representing that. The largest toy company in our business by the late 60s has a woman at its helm, right? Mattel Toys with Handler. So I think this is a moment for the toy business, in my reading of the history, of reading several decades worth of all of the major toy trade publications. I read Toys and Novelties, Toy and Hobby World, and Playthings, front to back, every single issue between 1950 and the early 1980s. And that really gave me some insight. Again, one particular kind of source, but some insight into what toy makers and people in the toy industry writ large are talking about and where their concerns are lying. And starting really in the early to mid 60s, people in the toy business are starting to talk more than they ever have before about the social changes that are happening outside of the toy building. And those social changes are changing their lives as people. And I interviewed a lot of toy makers and some of the toy greats of the time who are no longer with us, including Saul Robbins of Remco, among other people. And they sort of shared the ways in which those forces outside the doors of the toy building were seeping in, and right. how they couldn't be ignored anymore. And so many people were in favor of these changes. And so that's why you have the toy industry doing what it did in response to these movements, so that by 1974, I mean, literally 50 years ago tomorrow was the opening of the Toy Fair of 1974.
Wow.
It was an incredible moment when actually all of these movements that had been bubbling up for the previous decade, the peace movement around toys, the feminist movement around toys, the civil rights struggle around toys, converged. You had Fisher-Price offering its first set of dolls, the Fisher-Price dolls, 6 new dolls. 5 of them were white, but 1 of them was black. And this was a really big deal, and they put a lot of care and brought a lot of intention to the production of that black doll called Elizabeth in particular. Right. And I write about that in the book. 1974 also saw Milton Bradley introduce an incredible set of toys catering mainly toward the educational marketplace, because it was produced by Milton Bradley's famous educational division. But it was groundbreaking in its representation of white, black, Latino, and women professionals. It was a set that wasn't actually designed by Milton Bradley toy makers, but actually right. designed by a feminist activist and educator named Barbara Sprung, who was head of a group called the Women's Action Alliance. And she actually made some prototypes. She became a toy maker right. because she was looking around at the toy business, and they weren't producing exactly what she felt needed to be produced. So she made these prototypes out of wood at the wood shop at the school where she worked, which is just incredible.
Yeah.
Talk about do it yourself. But then she said, you know what? I could really use the help of the toy business. They could help me out. And I have a feeling there's someone there who's going to be interested, and they're going to take me up on this. And Ryan Weingartner, who was working as the head of the educational division at Milton Bradley at that time, said, yes, let's do it. And so in 1974, at the Toy Fair, they introduced these two sets called Our Helpers. And one of them was a series of sort of cardboard cutouts, representations of men and women of different races and genders in different roles. And so you had, for the first time in toy history, a representation of an Asian male nurse. And next to him, there was a representation of a white female nurse. You had a Latino male construction worker and a white female construction worker. This was the beginning of something new. And the toy industry has continued to produce these, but it really began with this incredible partnership. And I think that's also what my book is trying to bring to light for the first time, or in ways that historians and scholars haven't talked about so much, that this is a moment of incredible collaboration right. between the activists and the industry. It's not just about, you know, this adversarial battle for toys. It's actually about producing something new and engaging that, you know, kept up with the times and really tried to be responsive to what Americans wanted to see in their children's playroom.
And it's remarkable to me that what began as a lot of niche markets, because if we're looking at the 50s and we're looking at gunplay, for example, and how many guns that were out there, and Hubley, which was making the guns, the Roy Rogers and Dale Evans, and all of this, that guns became not only totems of heroes, but also totems of this American West for kids, for boys, especially playing power and conflict. These were really important. And it was only later that people would say, you know, is this really what we want to be talking about? To the point where today, when I go on a TV show, they don't want to see a gun of any kind. They don't want to see even a Nerf blaster, which is pretty innocuous because the society, I mean, it's over a 50-60 year arc, but that's how much the society has changed. And I think giving us the seed of that is so important. One other quick thing was when I worked at Ideal in the mid 80s, we had, if we were doing Betsy Wetsy and Tiny Tears and you wanted to make a black one, you simply put brown pellets in the mold instead of pinkish pellets in the mold. And there wasn't the sense of physiognomy. People thought, well, it's a girl playing with a little girl. It's just all it needs to be is a lump of plastic. Well, of the right color. Today we have different physiognomies, different body types, and people like, I want to talk about this company Shindala that you write about in the book, because that was a seminal company in changing perceptions.
Yes, the history of Shindana Toys is just incredible. And actually that was the next example I was going to give of what made the 1974 Toy Fair so historic. And it was that Shindana Toys, which had been around since 1968, leased permanent space in a showroom in the toy building. It's actually room 534 in the toy building, 1974, and Playthings reported on it. And I quote here, Playthings called it the first permanent display of black dolls in the building.
Wow.
So that's 50 years ago this week, the first permanent display of black dolls in the building. And it was there for another 8 years until Shindana ultimately closed down its factory. But the Shindana story is remarkable because just as you were saying, nowadays we have lots of companies, you know, some of the largest companies in the industry, and then some of the smaller sort of independent companies. I'm thinking of Healthy Roots or Black Dolls Matter, companies that are really paying attention to things that Shindana was pioneering in the late 1960s and early 70s when it came to representations of Black identity and Black culture, and really trying to highlight select physical and cultural markers of Blackness in fashion, in clothing, in hair, in facial features, in a way that they felt was celebratory, that was positive, and that could counter what was really sort of the conventions of the moment in the 1950s and 1960s in the making of black dolls, which was, as you say, and this was repeated later on too, right? In the 80s, they would just tint the plastic,
right?
Tint the plastic brown. But the original mold would be designed, right, based on the likeness of a white child. And so Shindana was actually the first company that I know in toy industry history to actually bring in young black children as models to design their molds. And they even began the process, this was in 1968, as they were just starting up, by inviting local high school students at a high school in South Central Los Angeles to submit their designs of a beautiful young black girl. And Shindana research and research and design folks, they took those and they created this composite image. So it was literally, the first doll, Baby Nancy, in 1968,
right,
was a reflection of what the black community around the Shindana factory actually thought a black doll should be.
What's significant about Shindana in 1968 is how the culture was evolving, because that was the year that a seminal TV show debuted, Julia, which was about a very positive image of a black nurse. And so many kids at the time wanted to be that boy, because they wanted that attention from mom, and it was transcending of race and reflecting the culture at the same time. So there was sort of a cultural opening for somebody like Shindana to fill that void.
Definitely. And it's interesting because in 1969, Mattel introduces a repackaged version of its Christie doll from 1968 called the Julia doll.
Right.
Representing Deanne Carroll's character from the television show. And later on, Shindana will, in the 1970s, be the only toy maker to create likenesses in the fashion doll business of black celebrity actors from all of the Norman Lear shows. They make a Red Fox doll. They make it's a talking plush Red Fox doll. They make a J.J. Walker doll, a talking J.J. Walker doll. Right. From Good Times. They also make from the Jeffersons. They make a Marla Gibbs doll. Marla Gibbs was the incredible firecracker comic who right. played Florence. The Jeffersons made. So Shindanna ends up entering that industry. It's interesting and doing these TV celebrity dolls. But what the connection between Shindanna and Mattel is really important.
Right.
And something we shouldn't forget. Shindanna really begins as a community development project and job training project in South Central Los Angeles that forms in the months after the Watts Rebellion and the riots that really hurt so much of the South Central Los Angeles community in 1965. And this community development project is called Operation Bootstrap. And it's founded by two civil rights activists, both of them African-American, and a bunch of other people who are supporting it. And one of them, Lou Smith, he had been in Mississippi during the Freedom Summer Project just a year earlier. He had worked in the Harlem office of the Congress of Racial Equality. Before that, he was someone who, went on, the radio and had a debate with Malcolm X. So these are civil rights leaders of the 1960s who are creating this community development and job training program. And what happens is they begin looking for some larger corporations who might help them train local people who are unemployed, who haven't had opportunities for education and training and industrial skills. And so they're working on this between 65 and 68. And someone connected to Mattel hears about what they're looking for. And Mattel's headquarters in Hawthorne are just a few miles west of Central Los Angeles. And so Elliot Handler and Art Spear call in the two leaders of this group called Operation Bootstrap. And they say, what do you think of a partnership? And Lou Smith and the other leader of Bootstrap, his name was Robert Hall. They said, sure, let's do it. We would really appreciate your assistance and support and your training. And Elliot Handler said, great, we'd love to help. But here's the thing. We don't want to help train, folks in your community and then bring you in and hire you to work for Mattel. We'd like to actually share some of our know-how, share our technical skills, and actually help you build your own toy company. And then we're just going to let it go. No strings attached. And Lou Smith and Robert Hall said, you've got a deal. Take it. And they had conversations about, what kind of toys were sort of missing from the market. And Lou Smith had always felt that there weren't enough positive representations of Black people in the toy business, especially in dolls. And so they decided, okay, our first toy is going to be a representation of a young Black child. And that became Baby Nancy. And Mattel gave hundreds of thousands of dollars in startup funds. They actually leased the factory in Watts, where Shindanna opened in October of 1968. And then they sent over several of their top managers to be advisors for a couple of years. And they basically worked for this new company, which took the name Shindanna, which means Swahili, means competitor in Swahili. And they sent these folks over, and they worked for Shindanna, still on Mattel payroll, but they really helped Shindanna get going for a couple of years. And later on, Lou Smith, said, we couldn't have done this without, sure, the money at first, that startup money, but it was also really their know-how, their technological knowledge, and what they were willing to share and do to help. I spoke on the phone to someone who worked for Mattel as a sales rep named Howard Neal. And he told me, and he was a young sales rep at the time in 68, just as this Shindanna project was starting. And he told me that Bernard Loomis and others who were his supervisors told him to just go down to South Central, go to the factory in Watts for Shindanna, and you just check in and see what they need. And you do whatever they need, help them out, support them. You don't even have to come into Hawthorne and, check in. If they need you, then they need you. And that's what we're doing right now. And so I think that's a remarkable moment for these group of civil rights activists to suddenly turn into toy makers. Right. And with Mattel's help, by 69, they're selling in the Sears catalog.
Right.
They're selling in Corvettes and Macy's all across the country by 70, 71. By 74, like I said, they've got a permanent showroom in the toy building, the first showroom of Black Dolls, and I think also the first Black-owned toy company to have a permanent showroom. But it's also a remarkable moment for Mattel.
Right.
And it's interesting because after a few initial items in the toy press in late 1968, Mattel basically says nothing about its support of this project, even though the support is ongoing for another couple of years.
Right.
It basically withdraws and says, we don't, you know, no strings attached. We're not part of this company. This company isn't a subsidiary or anything like that. And they're going to be a competitor and we're going to compete with them. And that's sort of what happens for the rest of the 70s.
And in addition to dolls, you also write about a company that was really important. It was called Olmec Toys, and they introduced the first Black action figures. And I knew, actually, Yala Eason. I talked to her on the phone several times as she was introducing it, because I think at the time I was writing for Toy and Hobby World, among other things. But
amazing.
That was a significant introduction, even though it didn't become overly successful. It opened the door to more things. Can you tell us a little bit about Olmec?
Olmec was founded by Black entrepreneur Yala Eason in 1985. And it was really prompted, as she tells the story, by her son asking, you know, where were the representations of Black action heroes and Black superheroes in the action figure market, which by the 1980s had really blown up, and especially the sort of smaller figure, whether 3 3/4 inch or 7 inch, since the Star Wars blockbuster of the late 70s. And of course, the early 1980s saw He-Man, G.I. Joe, among others. And so you can imagine that, you know, a young kid looking around and saying, you know, where are the representations? And I think the one place you would have found a little bit of that, a more diverse representation, was actually G.I. Joe.
Right.
From the very beginning, they actually had Black soldiers, and with some really elaborate backstories. And that's, I think, something that's super impressive about what the folks at Hasbro did with G.I. Joe from the very beginning. And I really see that as an extension of what Shindana was already doing in the early 70s, writing in these elaborate backstories so that these people had identities. But in terms of Yala Eason, she decides, okay, I'm going to go out and do it. I'm going to build this company. And we're going to focus on racially, ethnically diverse superheroes. And they're really fantastical. They include Black, Mexican, Asian, and Native American-inspired characters, these new superheroes of color. The company, she calls it Olmec Incorporated. And the company has a lot of success, and I think inspires a lot of larger companies to sort of take up the torch once again. I believe, though maybe I'm wrong here, I believe that the company's recently been reintroduced.
Okay.
And maybe owned by Hasbro, but I'm not sure on that. Maybe check on that.
Yeah.
I thought I saw Sunman the other day in a store.
And that may in fact be true, because again, Sunman was all about harnessing the power of the sun to do good. And I just remember the whole story behind that. And it was terrific. And it came at a time when there was a lot of sensibility. You mentioned Masters of the Universe, you mentioned Star Wars, that we started this very mythic legend kind of play, this storyline play that's continued today through Marvel. And the Marvel Universe is about as diverse as it could possibly be in terms of race, ability, gender, age, whatever. So it really does reflect a new world.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, when you say that, Chris, it also reminds us how these different industries that make culture for children have at different points in history, converged and diverged. And so, you know, it's in the 1960s when Marvel is already becoming more diverse in the comic books, but not yet. But the toy industry hasn't really caught up to that.
Right.
The toy, you know, and then, as we talked about earlier, the toy industry is is trying to connect with what children are watching on television, right? So they make the Julia doll, or they make the Red Fox doll, or the J.J. Walker doll, but still not necessarily connecting up with comics. And then I think really it's the genius of the folks behind Masters of the Universe and others that follow in that mold in the 1980s of creating a total universe of characters and worlds and these, you know, relationships. And you have this sort of a great tree of relationships, right, and family, almost like a family structure, that really owes so much to what comics had actually been doing for decades. And then now, 20, 25, 30 years later, you have this convergence once again of the comics, the movies, and the toys in sort of the Marvel universe. It's just interesting to think about that.
And I want to shift gears for a moment, because one of the things that's always fascinated me is that the toy industry is a lightning rod industry, right? Mm. It becomes an easy target for a lot of criticism. And I always think of Henry V's speech, because of course toys and Shakespeare go together. But, you know, upon the king, he says, "Let us our lives, our souls, our debts, our careful wives put upon the king. Let's blame the king for everything." And so very often the toy industry gets blamed for things. I was just saying to somebody the other day that Barbie is inherently a lump of largely polyvinyl chloride. So inherently it is neutral. It is what we project onto it. So as I read some of the things you've recounted so beautifully about, you know, the passion with which people approach this, it's important to move the needle in history. At the same time, it doesn't really get how children perceive things. So there's a lot of application of adult sensibility to a toy.
It's so true. You're right. You're right. It's toys are all about the meanings that we assign to them. And those meanings are going to shift depending on, you know, where we are as a society. And of course, we live in societies that have, you know, great diversity. And so we're sometimes divided as a society. I mean, one of the challenges for the toy business as it faced the sort of those first rounds of criticism, and I would say the heaviest criticism of the toy business, where activists didn't want to listen to reason, didn't want to listen to other psychological arguments, right, about, you know, child development or boys' development, was the early to mid 1960s.
Yep.
When the peace movement sort of snapped into action and said, "We're going to take on toys as well as taking on the war," they just weren't really willing to give an inch. So the moment for the toy industry where they face the greatest challenge, I think, in terms of sort of angry protest, is the peace movement taking on toys. This is led by the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom and Women's Strike for Peace, which are mainly fighting, you know, war and nuclear armament and proliferation. And they see toys as symbols of that in their own home. And what's interesting is when you actually speak to some of the leaders of those movements who were demonstrating outside the toy fair 60 years ago,
right,
60 years ago in March, they were demonstrating for the first time outside the toy fair, but it would not be the last time. They would do it every other toy fair for the next decade through the mid 70s. And you talk to them, several of the leaders, including Victoria Reese, she's one of the New York City leaders. She made it really clear to me that at the time, there were very few among them who were really saying that little boys shouldn't play with something that might look like a toy gun, or they might turn into a toy gun like a stick. And many actually had a soft spot for Western toys and, you know, Wild West, Bat Masterson, Six Shooters.
Right, right.
And things like that. It was that in this moment when they were watching television and they were seeing the war unfold before their eyes on the nightly news with Walter Cronkite every single night, to then turn and look at their kid holding this very realistic weapon. And it just so happens, this is just one of these conjunctures of history where the industry had gone into the production of the most realistic,
right,
weapons ever, and very much cast in the World War II eras weapon technology, that they just felt really unnerved by it. uncomfortable. But it's interesting because the leader of the New York City anti-war toy movement, who made waves not only in New York City, but all across the country, Victoria Reese, said, you know, I support my own son's playing with, you know, playing with these things. He just doesn't want them to be so realistic. The dominant prevailing attitude among psychologists at the time was that this was a form of sublimation, that it was healthy release, and the kids didn't see the realistic war toy as actually a toy machine gun, that wasn't going to make them into a warmonger or even lead them to want to get a real gun like that. That kids understand the difference between a toy and the real thing. And this is something that Brian Sutton Smith used to talk about a lot. The kids really, really see the difference between, you know, what is a toy and what is not a toy. And when they're playing, the toy is the thing. And it's not like they're playing with the real world, or they're playing with the real world, but they're not seeing it as something that actually has impact beyond the play and the imagination.
And kids are so inherently solipsistic, right? That they are really just, they are thinking about themselves. And there's a wonderful book that I've talked about often by Gerard Jones called Killing Monsters. And it's why children need this kind of play. And it's just for that cathartic release, for understand taking on a powerful role. It's like I always say, when your life is, you know, eat your peas, get in the minivan, do your homework, do what your dad says, suddenly being all powerful, whether it's through an action figure or a blaster, very healthy for kids.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that's interesting about that is that the toy companies that came out against war toys in a very public way in the mid-1960s, they include Creative Playthings, run by Frank Kaplan, who was previously a longtime early childhood educator in progressive schools and had worked for the WPA. And then another one is Lego. Lego came out against war toys. AMSCO actually came out against war toys in 1966 at the Toy Fair. These companies came out, Lionel Toys.
Right, they had a whole ad campaign.
Lionel had an entire ad campaign called, you know, Nice Toys Don't Kill.
Right.
and they would show a photograph of, you know, a train going around on the tracks, one of its iconic train sets. And they would say, you know, this toy doesn't explode or maim or go rat-a-tat-tat. But with the exception actually of Lionel, that in previous years had actually made some military train cars.
Right.
With that exception, all of these other companies didn't actually sell war toys. So they came out against something that, you know, wasn't going to affect their bottom line. They didn't have to remove anything from their catalog. Lionel actually did have to remove something for their catalog.
We would call that virtue signaling today. But it really points up to the fact that the toy industry has always been responsive to the market, and that smart marketers saw an opportunity and they seized on it. And if you're talking to a mom who's looking for that, really, really, what's the harm? It's really because if a mom is looking for that, it can be reinforcing. And so the toy industry is often painted as like this evil empire trying to corrupt the minds of children. But I think you make it really clear that that's not true in the book, because there are many points like what you just described with the guns, where we're not only seeing a shift in perception about the toys, but we're seeing a cultural shift. And that moment of cultural shift is really opens up new opportunities for the toy companies and for the culture.
Yeah. And I think when things get really bad and people, or a larger number of people, the society as a whole, the nation as a whole, feels that, you know what, we're uncomfortable right now selling toy guns, then we're going to stop. And that actually happens in the summer of 1968 after the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy.
Right.
Which comes, of course, just 2 months after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And it's at that moment where the toy industry sort of coordinates an effort among manufacturers, retailers, to basically put a pause and sort of call for an unofficial moratorium on the marketing of realistic sort of modern war toys. Sears Roebuck, Montgomery Ward, they pull the ads from their catalogs. many of the companies, again, stop putting those ads on television. In the 1970s, those ads don't return, not for realistic war toys. Ads return for other kinds of, you know, Western guns and rifles. But the realistic war toys are sort of missing after that from at least television commercials, which is interesting. So in that moment, you know, Playthings is weighing in and saying, at this moment, we don't feel comfortable about it. We don't feel comfortable about it. And of course, that's coming from their consumers, right?
Right.
And feel at that moment that it's not just a small group of pacifists or anti-war activists who are saying, can you just quiet with the guns and the representations of weapons right now? It's the masses of American consumers, and it's, you know, the average mother. And so they're listening. And that's, I think, the challenge of the toy industry. You know, the challenge of the toy industry, as I write about in the book, throughout the 60s and 70s, is that this is a moment of such, you know, turbulence and upheaval and change, and also a moment when the country is moving in different directions at once. And so how do you create a product that's going to make parents and kids happy? All of them, no matter where they are right. in the political spectrum, who they're voting for president, what they think about the war. I mean, ultimately, the business is there to, you know, make kids happy. And if they make kids happy, they're going to, you know, be profitable and get to continue coming up with really fun, exciting new ideas for toys. I mean, that's how I understand it. And that's, yeah. And so you want to make something new, and you know, there can be virtue signaling for sure. And sometimes I get the sense that maybe there were just a few people who in a company that might have seen it as virtue signaling, or it wasn't their concern to sort of speak about politics to parents. But then there might have been other people in the same company that said, you know, I also think this is a good thing to do. I think this is the right thing to do. There were folks at Ideal, actually, who in 1974, to celebrate another 50th anniversary, Ideal introduces the Dairy Daring
right.
action gear.
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah. And, you know, folks were interviewed from Ideal officials. This is not just sort of in the ad copy, which appeals to, you know, the women's liberation movement right. and she's strong and assertive and brave. But Ideal officials in interviews talked about how there's a lot of sexist representation and there's a history of that. And we're going to acknowledge that. And we're going to try to do something a little different. And they make the Dairy Daring doll, and she's, you know, she's racing around just like her counterpart, Evel Knievel, the best-selling
right.
the previous year. And she's still got, you know, a hot pink outfit and long blonde hair. So she still fits into sort of a popular mold of what femininity should look like, or sort of ideal femininity should look like. But she's also, you know, riding this hot rod and doing tricks. She's, you know, an attempt by Ideal, as I see it, to speak to, you know, mothers who are looking at what's going on around them, and they're seeing the feminist movement, and they're seeing how broad it can be, and that it's ultimately about, you know, rights of all people and opportunities for all people. And they want to share that with their children. You know, another company at that moment, Kenner, introduces also 1974 at the Toy Fair, the Dusty doll,
right.
you know, an attempt to sort of tap into, you know, young girls and their mothers being really excited about Title IX and all the opportunities right. that have come about in just 2 years for girls to play sports in, you know, middle school and high school, to join softball teams and volleyball teams and, you know, be part of that culture of athletics, which is such a, you know, central part of American culture, but had actually forever basically excluded girls and young women. And so the Dusty doll is an attempt to, you know, again, speak to that and not just, you know, tap into it or exploit it, but actually, you know, help mothers share that message that, hey, girls, you can do this. You know, it prefigures, you know, the Barbie, you know, girls can do anything.
We girls can do anything, yeah.
It prefigures that by a decade.
Almost a decade. Yeah. 9 years, I think. Yeah.
It's pretty remarkable. And so The only reason those dolls are discontinued, the Dusty and the Derry aren't there in the market within a couple of years, is that TV once again converges with the toy industry, and you have the $6 million man and then the Bionic Woman.
Right.
So Kenner drops Dusty, in at least my interpretation. They drop Dusty because now they have Lindsay Wagner and they have the Jamie Summers doll.
Right.
And that becomes a blockbuster hit of 76.
Yeah. But it's the legacy. And it's the legacy in that, my joke is, in 1959, Barbie had two options: fashion model or bride. In 65 years later, she's had hundreds and hundreds of careers, different body types, different things. So we really can track the trajectory of that over time. Rob, what you've written is a fascinating, readable, and very important book. And I think that one of the things I talk about all the time is how important it is for people in our industry to understand the history of toys. And I think it gets short shrift at times. You've certainly given it long shrift, especially for a period. And I so appreciate it. I so appreciate the book. The book is called Radical Play, and we will link to where you can buy it in the description. Rob Goldberg, author, teacher, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Chris, for having me on the show. It's really an honor.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this conversation, and I really encourage you to dig further into this fascinating era, not just as history, but how it can inform the industry today. You'll find a link to purchase Rob's book in the description. The Playground Podcast is supported by Global Toy News, The Toy Guy, and Beacon Media Group. I'm Chris Byrne. And we'll see you next time.